With deepest gratitude and everlasting astonishment, I accept the 1979 John Newbery Medal and the awesome covenant it exacts on behalf of my young, my dedicated, my loyal readers. I had dreamed of this moment many times, but this is nothing like my dream. There, in vain reverie, I would stand before a cheering but faceless crowd, outside of time, outside of space, flaunting the Caldecott Medal. As proof to the paucity of my imagination, here I stand in an ideal setting, at a perfect time, celebrating the honor of the Newbery Medal with friends, colleagues, and the worshipped idols of my childhood, librarians. Librarians who unlocked their treasure chest of riches to the lost child that I was, and who now add my small gift to their miraculous hoards. And my family is here. My husband, Dennis Flanagan, my daughter and son-in-law, Susan and Jim Metcalf, who have given me so much love that I'd plenty left over to lavish on the characters in the Westing game. This indeed is not a dream. On the other hand, this moment is too good to be real. Life, quirky though it may be, does not improve upon dreams. Life is not this generous with its rewards. Then what place is this that is neither reverie nor reality? I seem to be somewhere where anything can happen, somewhere deeper than dreams and truer than life. This somewhere could only be a book. I stand here in a book, written by an author who has bestowed upon this middle chapter the happiest of interim endings, an author whose profound and satiric wit, whose flawless sense of time and place, make me gasp in admiration. This ceremony could have been set in Milwaukee, my hometown, or in Pittsburgh, the home of the dedicatees of my book and the Westinghouse Corporation. But that would have been too obvious. As my readers can tell you, I have a strong aversion to the obvious. Dallas is just right. Here I was warmly welcomed before any medal came my way by the children of the Richardson and Garland schools, who read books, talked books, bought books. Besides, in this fantasy of fantasies, what better place to celebrate a book about money and millionaires than Texas? If the locale is ideal, the timing is exquisite. 1 week from the 4th of July in the International Year of the Child. To be honored for my contribution to American literature for children in this year of all years is cause for wonder. I do write books for children, consciously and proudly, but now I must ask myself, why, what, how? To me, writing for a reading child does not mean preaching or teaching. I leave that to the more qualified. It does not mean prescriptive formula. If I had the need for formulas, I would write for adults. It does not mean catering to arbitrary reading levels or age groups. My readers have one thing in common. They are young enough or curious enough to read slowly, and the slower the better for my books. The one literary concession I do make, one that forces me to eliminate words here and add sentences there, is to the look of the book. I write and design my book to look accessible to the young reader. It will have less than 200 pages, and there will be no endless seas of gray type. I plan for margins wide enough for the hands to hold, typographic variations for the eyes to rest, decorative breaks for the mind to breathe. I want my children's book to look like a wonderful place to be. But why? Why, as an adult, do I write books for children? I have thought long and hard about this too often asked question, and the only answer I can come up with is maybe because I'm short. I may not appear short to some of you, but believe me, I've spent most of my years looking up people's noses. As a child, being school bright was little compensation for being a year younger than my Nordic classmates. Great expectations were had of me when I was skipped to the third grade, but then and there, my string of perfect report cards was broken. I flunked posture. A shy child, I lacked the courage to explain that I was standing up straight. I was just shorter than anyone else. To add injury to insult, the geography books I had to balance on my head probably squashed me down another 2 inches. And not having eyes on the top of my flattened skull, I could no longer name the states that border on the Mississippi. I did have a brief respite from shortness. Having grown up as far as I could, I left the tall state of Wisconsin to launch a successful career as a freelance illustrator, eye to eye with the average-sized natives of New York City. Then, one unforgettable afternoon, Susie left her house key at school, and I was soon to step back into the frustrations of the undersized. The doorbell rang. I rose from my drawing board, crossed the room, opened the front door, and looked up at my 12-year-old daughter. Up, not down. Short again and forevermore, I started my first children's book. With the comfort of hindsight, I could look back and smile at my early moping self. Lucky adult that I became, I offered Nothing Ever Happens on My Block to the right editor, Jean Carl. To Jean, many thanks for showing me the way into children's literature. And to Suzanne Glazer, many kisses for your boundless enthusiasm that has kept me there. Switching from commercial art to picture books is plausible, but what about from picture books to the novel? Simple. All it takes is a brilliant editor, Ann Durrell, who in a rare lapse into looniness, asked this illustrator to write a long book, and who, a year later, when the moon again was full, confronted by the unlikeliest of novels, not what she had in mind at all, she may be crazy, but the author is even nuttier, had the courage to publish it. Thank you, Anne, for letting me keep this medal. At least half of it belongs to you and to the other good people at E.P. Dutton, Julie Zurcher and Ricky Levinson, who worked with such devotion on The Westing Game, and Mimi Caden. Mimi, my love for all the little things and all the big things you did to help our books find their readers. Had Ann Durrell and I had our wits about us, we might not have been so surprised at my funny way with words. Those years of art training, those many more years of sketching and drawing, sharpened my eye to the out of scale, the out of proportion. Everything looks weird if you stare long enough. The visual artist looks and can see beauty in the absurd, magic in the mundane. What varies from the norm describes the norm, and how much easier it is to tell those meanings in words. In words, with words, words about words. Words are adaptable tools to a dedicated reader. To the illustrator, words become tools as brushes have been, and brushstrokes are meant to be visible. If that is not reason enough for my wordplay, I happen to be married to the word master of all time. After living almost 20 years with a man who never lets a word pass by without twisting it, refining it, defining, or redefining it, a bit of his mastery should have rubbed off on me. Thanks, Dennis. Well, the words kept coming. The mysterious disappearance of Leon, I mean Noel, then Figs and Phantoms, then the tattooed potato and other clues. And then, 3 years ago, I sat down at the typewriter with no wisp of an idea, just the urge to write another children's book. It will have a story. It will have a character with whom my readers can relate. And because of who I am and was, and out of my compassion for the hurts and hazards of childhood, it will have a happy ending. But what shall I write about? It is 1976, the bicentennial year. My story will have a historical background. Its locale, the place I know best, Milwaukee. I now have my first character, Lake Michigan. Recalling that Amy Kelman's daughter asked for a puzzle mystery, I decide that the format of my historical treatise will be a puzzle mystery, whatever that is. I type out the words to America the Beautiful and cut them apart. Meanwhile, on television, between recreated revolutionary battles blasting and fireworks booming, come reports of the death of an infamous millionaire. Anyone who can spell Howard Hughes is forging a will. Good, I'll try it too. Now I have Lake Michigan, a jumbled America the Beautiful, the first draft of a very strange will, and a dead millionaire. A fine beginning for a puzzle mystery, but where is the historical background? Wisconsin abounds in labor history. Therefore, my millionaire will be an industrialist. Murdered because, let me see, because he was a notorious strikebreaker, Old Man Kohler. I shift the scene 60 miles north to my father's hometown, Sheboygan, which borders on the Kohler Company, factory, and town. I cannot use the name Sheboygan. My readers will think I'm trying to be funny. And I certainly cannot use the name Kohler. They're still making toilets up there. Instead, I raise the shore of Lake Michigan, and my industrialist, named Samuel W. Westing, will die in his mansion on the cliff called the Westing House. Now I need heirs, lots of them. Since my books collect characters, invited or not, I plan for a goodly number at the start. 16 seems a goodly number, almost too good. I will pair them, 8 pairs of heirs. Imperfect heirs. My characters will be imperfect, each handicapped by some physical, emotional, or moral defect. Defects which will make them easier to remember. Imperfect, because aren't we all? And in honor of the bicentennial, they will be melting pot characters, Polish, Jewish, German, Greek, Chinese, black. With the blind arrogance of the possessed, I devise 16 imperfect ethnics. Ordinary folk, dressmaker, judge, cook, podiatrist, maid, inventor, secretary, student. This is getting boring. A reluctant bride-to-be, a birdwatcher in a wheelchair, a 13-year-old girl who plays the stock market. Still boring. A bookie, a burglar, a bomber. That's better. And the murderer will limp. Out of respect for my plodding, rereading readers who never miss a clue, if the murderer limps, I must make most of my characters, at one time or another, limp. I am off and typing. I still don't know who is the bookie, who is the bomber, who killed Sam Westing, or why everyone is gimping around, but no matter. The characters will shape the action. The action will shape the characters. My characters will show me the way. And so they do. Grown-ups are so obvious, Turtle says in my book. That may be, but I am too quick to scoff at others' faults before they scoff at mine. With time, I tolerate the imperfections of the stranger. With acquaintance, I begin to understand. With caring, the faults fall away, and I perceive, in rare times touch, the true being of a friend. So too when I write. Those characters, whom I myself create and name, begin as strangers. Slowly, slowly, they take shape and grow and cast shadows on one another and on me. I learn to like them, to love them. Although I rewrite my story many times, I try not to alter this fragile metamorphosis. I would like my readers to share that joy of watching those ridiculous strangers become good friends. Unfortunately, I end up loving all of my characters. None of them could possibly be a murderer. And mean old Sam Westing, he isn't so mean after all once you get to know him. I cannot let him die. Now I really have a problem. How can there be a will if nobody died? It is rewrite time. The plot thickens and thickens but refuses to gel, and I refuse to give up. $200 million is at stake, and I too want to win. Knitting and unraveling, knotting and unknotting, I rewrite the manuscript again and again. At last, hallelujah, at last, I find the answer to the question I forgot to ask. The plot comes full circle, all points of the compass are touched, the game is won. My book is done. Sam Westing, the rascal, almost outwitted me with not one but 4 disguises. I almost outwitted myself. My tribute to American labor history ended up a comedy in praise of capitalism. In the larger sense, however, it did turn out to be exactly what I wanted it to be, a children's book. It is the book that is the important thing, not who I am or how I did it, but the book. Not me, the book. I fear for the book in this age of inflated personalities, in which the public's appetite for an insight to the lives of the famous has been whetted by publicity puffers and profit pushers into an insatiable hunger for gossip. I worry that who the writer is has become of more interest than what the writer writes. I'm concerned that this dangerous distortion may twist its way into children's literature. I do understand the attempt to introduce books to children through its authors, and in my travels I have seen it done effectively and well. I salute all efforts to encourage reading. But an author is not a performer. Meeting a writer is not a substitute for reading a book. It is the book that lives, not the author. It is not I that is being honored here tonight. It is my book. For that great honor, I am sincerely grateful to Dr. Cianciolo, the members of the Newbery Caldecott Awards Committee, and the Association for Library Service to Children. What becomes of Ellen Raskin is of little matter on this occasion. What does matter, what we are celebrating here tonight, is that Turtle and Angela and Chris and Sadell, all 16 of my beloved characters, are alive and well, and forevermore will be playing the Westing Game. I hold the Newbery Medal in my hand, but the shinier one is on the book. Thank you all, and a very happy 4th of July.